So last week we looked at holiness in the context of the Western tradition and the discussion with Aquinas and Duns Scotus and Avicenna, if you remember. And we got from that, what I want to take with us is the notion of the formal distinction from Duns Scotus. And we'll park that for a bit. You know, there's a, like before for him, between the persons of the Trinity, there's only a formal distinction between the persons of the Trinity. It's not a real distinction. And so I was using that, and then we use that in the connection to the category holiness. There's not a real distinction between holiness, holy things and people, and that to which they point. So it's a formal distinction rather than a real one. So I'm going to pick up on that more next time, but... So I thought we'd look at, rather than, we were going to do, is holiness outside of language? That's an interesting question, but I thought we'd look at something prior. So what is holiness? So only yesterday I thought we'd look at that, and so that's why I'm late, because I was finishing off this handout. So what is holiness? So I mean, the semantic range of holiness is quite wide in English. So we mean, what do we mean by it? We mean a quality of places. So I'm just going to kind of read through the handout here. Quality of places, things and people. Set aside from everyday transaction and regarded as the expression of a source transcendent to the human world. And that's possible. That's a possible understanding. Within that, that is within the semantic range of the category. B, an intellectual object towards which certain practices are orientated. Now, last week, if you remember, I think we need to problematize that, because Avicenna, I don't know how to pronounce his name, that Aquinas responds to. Do you remember? He asks the question: What's the intellectual object of metaphysics? And then he says it can't be God. Or he says first of all, yeah, it's God. Okay. Then he changes his mind. Saying it can't be God because God exceeds any boundaries. So it can't be an intellectual object because that implies something standing outside of God. So that can't be the case. So he says then you must be looking at. The object of metaphysics is not the first cause, but secondary causes. So, likewise here, if holiness, if holiness is an intellectual object towards which certain practices are orientated, is that even possible? Because, can holiness itself be an intellectual object, or is it only, as I think, certain particular instances of holiness are intellectual objects? But not holiness itself. Anyway, that's something I want, another issue that to park for the next discussion. So, as a quality of things or places, holiness is conceptualized by religions as a mysterious property that is given life from a transcendent source. But as a quality of people, it is linked to, but not coterminous with, goodness. Often we think a saint is a good person. Holiness is often linked to goodness. Now, this is a problem. And there's a debate about what holiness denotes that questions that idea of the linking of holiness with goodness. So on the one hand, holiness has been identified by Rudolf Otto in that kind of, you know, the 1917 he published that book, with a particular kind of apprehension of overwhelming amoral power. He's getting all that from Schleiermacher. I'm not going to go into a description of Otto today, I don't think. So while on the other hand, it's been identified, at least in Jewish philosophy, as with ethics, as a summation of the good. So we've got our first impasse, our first problem. Is, on the one hand, holiness, there's an emphasis on, in terms of ontology, what the being of holiness. On the other hand, there's an emphasis on ethics and axiology. So this is all highlighted in Mittelman's book on... came out about 4 years ago now, on holiness in the Jewish tradition, Jewish thought. So this is a problem. So in contrast to Otto, the latter position, that ethics is central to the category holiness, is a position generally maintained by Jewish thinkers such as Heschel. Now Mittelman calls these the ontological and the axiological. In the former case, holiness is a property of places and people, as the colour red is a property of a ball. In the latter case, holiness is purely relational, as large ascribed to a ball is only meaningful in contrast to small or good, or a good horse is good only because it's faster than the others and that kind of thing. So it's relational. So on this view, holiness is the evaluation and assertion of a value. So you've got these two views that Mittelman outlines, which I think is a good way of getting into this problem. And this contrast between the ontological and the axiological view needs to be understood as a necessary dialectic, I think, that captures what is encompassed by the term. So what is holiness? Holiness encompasses at least these two categories, the ontological and the axiological, the amoral power, overwhelming amoral power, and being good, leading a good life or being kind to others and all that sort of thing. So this contrast between the ontological and the axiological view needs to be understood as a necessary dialectic, I think. So what Mittelman calls the ontological understanding is in fact an issue about otherness and power that has the potential to overwhelm human reality and so risk submerging or erasure of the human, which is what Otto's position is fundamentally, it seems to me. So the axiological model, on the other hand, begins with the human relationality and risks the limitation of holiness as numinous power, or risks understanding ethics as comportment to a merely horizontal dimension without a cosmic significance. So if you understand holiness as overwhelming ontological power, that run in the intellectual risk of submerging the human, of minimizing the human, human relationality, in the face of this overwhelmingness of the other. And on the other hand, if you emphasize it's just ethics, you've lost something with the category holiness. It becomes purely relationality at a horizontal level. So you need a verticality, or you need the ontological dimension as well. So it seems to me that the category holiness has to encompass, there has to be a dialectic between the ontological and the axiological. So let's call these dimensions the overwhelming as numinous power and the ethical, which is comportment, as a redescription of Mittelman's tension between ontology and axiology, between human experiences being overwhelmed by otherness and ways of being in the world conducive to the common good. So I think we can look at holiness in those two terms. They might be incompatible, but I don't know. We can present a hypothesis that there's a dialectic between them. So is this tension between the overwhelming and the ethical undeconstructible in human reality? Is that just an undeconstructible fact of the human? So both the overwhelming and the ethical, the ontological and the axiological, point to each other and coexist in and as human truth. So the quality of the ethical that underlies it as holy is its implicit reference to the overwhelming, reference to a numinosity that speaks to an invisible power. So, hypotheses, here we go. Ethical act is only holy insofar as it implicitly references the overwhelming. Truth of the human is in history through ethical engagement with otherness, and beyond history an overwhelming numinosity that speaks to invisible power. So there's a hypothesis, it might be wrong, but it's a hypothesis that the two are related, that these two aspects or dimensions. Now the problem of the relation of holiness as power to holiness as ethics is one that I think we need to look at and address. So the former begins with the problem of otherness and risks submerging or erasure of the human. I just said this, haven't I? The latter begins with human relationality and risks the erasure or limitation of the holy as numinosity, or the reduction of the ethical comportment to merely horizontal dimension without cosmic significance. Now each points to the other in the sense that they are grounded in the nature of the human. And being human entails both apprehension of numinous power, of overwhelming otherness, alongside ethical comportment to and within world. What grounds these in holiness is the necessary abduction to holiness from these two forms of human comportment. Now, I'm going to talk about that in the last session four. I think you can present an abductive argument for holiness based on these two comportments, if you like, in human nature, I would even stick my neck out and say. So there's a dynamic tension then between numinous power and ethical comportment, but they both reference the holiness in itself. I haven't used that phrase, but something like that. There's a dynamic tension between power and ethics, between ontology and ethics, between human experiences being overwhelmed by otherness and ways of being in the world conducive to the common good. A tension between the transhuman overwhelming and human welcoming and accommodation of difference. So also, this also relates to something which next topic of the lecture, the political nature of holiness. So on the one hand, you've got apolitical overwhelming power, and on the other hand, you've got necessary ethics, which is comportment towards each other, which is necessarily political. As we'll see, Agamben reads that in a purely negative way. It's just bad news. It ended up in the Holocaust for Agamben. But so he wants to, you know, we should, for the human future, we should ditch religion, really. Ditch holiness. Ditch the holy man. But anyway, so we'll look at that next week. So there are interesting issues that begin to emerge. Sorry, I'm whizzing through this because I think we've got quite a lot to discuss. So the ethical act is only holy insofar as it implicitly references the overwhelming. Truth of the human is in history through ethical engagement with otherness, and beyond history, an overwhelming numinosity that speaks to invisible power. So this distinction in the human between the overwhelming and the ethical maps onto the distinction between theology and philosophy, arguably, where theology charts or theorizes the overwhelming as the God of revelation, and philosophy theorizes the human being in the world as ethical act. There can be an inability of the ethical to cope with the overwhelming, as we see in the dark vitalism of the 20th century. And the inability of the overwhelming to face up to the force of ethical position, as we'll discuss next time. But holiness cannot be reduced to either the overwhelming or the ethical, but we need to inquire more deeply into this process of the appearance of holiness in these two modes. And two issues I think are important. The for whom is holiness an appearance, and of what? The of what I'm going to talk about in week four, and the of whom today and next time. So of whom, for whom, sorry, not of whom, for whom is holiness an appearance, and of what? What is that overwhelming to which the appearances point? Now, the experience of holiness necessitates an approach that simultaneously describes it and explains it. In locating holiness in feeling, Rudolf Otto implicitly placed the experience of holiness outside of language. So this is the other section was going to be is there holiness within language or outside of language? And so it relates to Otto because he thought it was outside of language. Yet if language is constitutive of human reality and not only descriptive of it, then what does this mean to claim that the experience of holiness could be pre-linguistic or prior to language, as Otto and others have thought? So he's getting, I'm sure you know, but he's getting all this from Schleiermacher, a lot of it from Schleiermacher, although he disagrees with Schleiermacher on certain points. But Schleiermacher was that, who's heard of Schleiermacher? Everyone. Yeah. That's interesting, I'm just curious. Some people haven't heard of Schleiermacher. Well, okay. Yeah, he's terribly important. Theologian in the beginning of the 19th century, well, the first half. I don't know when he dies, probably about 1820 or something, is it? Something like that. Yep. Something like that. He's a contemporary of Hegel. And that time there were three faculties. Will, what's a human being? You can describe a human being as willing, thinking, or feeling, those three faculties. And Hegel had emphasized thinking. We're the whole cosmic thought process going on. And Schleiermacher disagreed with that. He thought, that religious apprehension is based in feeling of an apprehension of the holy other, that which is wholly other to us and which can overwhelm us. So willing, thinking, and feeling. So Kant arguably located the essence of the human in the will, probably. But anyway, so Schleiermacher's, yeah, and Otto's picking up on Schleiermacher because he had edited his book as well on religion. So I don't want to talk about Otto, though, really, but he's behind all this. So he's the key person in the non-linguistic understanding of holiness, if you like. Now, to address this issue, I think we need to go back to some basic claims of phenomenology and try to build an understanding, a new understanding, sensitive to the constitutive view that we're, as humans, language constitutes us. It's not like it just doesn't, not something that just describes us, but it actually forms who we are, you know. It's constitutive. We are linguistic beings. So we need to. So that view has had such a profound effect and impact on the humanities, while at the same time recognizing the pre-linguistic, some somatic bodily experience as the ground upon which the linguistically constituted view can be formulated. So, yeah, obviously, we all listen to music and we go for a walk in the countryside, or we kind of, you know, climb up a mountain. And they're kind of, I'm not sure if they're non-linguistic, but they're certainly, they're on the edges of language, aren't they? So there are certain human experiences which are which are hard to describe. But nevertheless, I think we're predominantly constituted by language, but which is what I was going to talk about, but I'm not now. So back to basics. Who are we? So going back to our readings of phenomenology, we read Heidegger's Sein und Zeit for 2 years during lockdown, and reading that, it was very exciting because it seems like it's a discovery. He's making a discovery about human reality, which is being in the world. And so the Cartesian, you know, I think, therefore I am, and there's the I can doubt everything except that I think, is Heidegger says, well, it's not wrong, he says, but it's not true. It's not true. There's a deeper reality of being in the world. Dasein, being there, and which is time. So time is being is time. There's not sort of some atex. This is a new discovery, I reckon, anyway. And then there's a book we're reading now, Experience in the Absolute, by Yves-Jean Lacoste, which came out in 1994. And he extends Heidegger's understanding of being in the world. In that book, and he says, to respond to the question, who am I, we need to respond to, where am I? And it's necessary that I'm in a place. So, you know, you can look through the index of Heidegger, you won't find body, eh? He's not really interested in body, but it's nevertheless implicitly there. So Jean-Yves Lacoste tries to bring all that out, and talks about place, its location. So being in the world, it means actually to be in a place. Where am I? I'm in a particular place. So it's necessary that I'm in a place. And place is not space, he says, because it furnishes us with the coordinates of life and existence. Place furnishes us with the coordinates of life and existence. Where we are, who we are, depends on where we are, on the place in which we are. And space is more neutral, you know. So you could argue that actually, a different topic, religion transforms space into place, arguably. But anyway, Lacoste picks up on some of this. Mind, here's a note for your diary before I forget. On the 30th of May, Lacoste is coming to Campion Hall, give a lecture with Kevin Hart. So stick that in your diaries. It has yet to be announced. So, no experience of the self can bracket the body, says Lacoste. And so bracket the relational of proximity to which the body binds us. The experience of the body is the experience of place as much as time. My body, quote, my body is thus inescapable for me, both as a condition of consciousness and as a perpetually present to consciousness. My place is thus inescapable for me as well, end quote. So body, you need a body to be in a place, you need a body. Do you need a body to be in a place? You probably do. I take possession of the place because it is my place, and the world proclaims something different from different or other. So we're always in a location. It's kind of obvious in a way, but Lacoste is bringing it out. So being there, Dasein, is being in, and our relation to the world is one of inherence. Humanity, who he calls it man, has place in the world or possesses a world, in contrast to an animal, he says, that only has an environment. Well, I don't know about that. I don't know. He doesn't get out very much in Paris. Yeah. I don't think he's ever seen any animals. But you could, anyway, so just a throwaway remark he makes. He's a bit of a troglodyte, isn't he? He can't sleep, so he just wanders around the house all night. But you could do that down in Camping Mall. So that's place. Okay, so we're in a place, which is terribly important. So he extends Dasein, being in the world, is actually, what is that? It's being in a place. So if we accept that, okay, one of the descriptions of us as human beings, not as souls, but as embodied creatures, is being in a place. Okay. Common sense, no problem. He then goes on to discuss world. Place is perceived as world and location as being in the world. We're doing this because we want to get at holiness, but we're going back to what a human being, what we are in the world, to get at holiness again. So that's why I'm describing Lacoste's book. So place is perceived as world and location as being in the world. Oh, before we go on to that, does everyone know what bracketing is? Bracketing. Epoche. Oh, you don't. Okay. So this is a guy, Husserl was the founder of phenomenology, and he said, how do we get around the problems of philosophy? Which he said was mainly, sorry for those of you who know all this, idealism, i.e. the world's only in your head, or materialism, the world's materially real, and so all ideas are epiphenomena of consciousness, epiphenomena of material reality. So that's a problem in philosophy. It's a boring problem. How can we get around that? He said, I know, let's bracket out, let's put brackets around, epoche, the reality of the world, or the reality of human experience. So so what we're left with is the flow of appearances, cogitationes, to the cogito, the I think. You've got the flow of the cogitationes or the cogitatum, and you bracket the being behind the appearances. It's not that you bracket your subjectivity. He said you can't bracket your subjectivity. Now here he says, yeah, you can't bracket your subjectivity, Husserl. You're right there. But not only that, you can't bracket the body. You can't bracket out the being of the body, and being of a place, being in a place. So it's even, he extends the Husserlian bracketing to location. So he then goes on to speak about world. The world is both near, because it's accessible, and distant, because it cannot be circumscribed by experience. So the world exceeds us, exceeds my experience. We cannot abstract ourselves from world without losing our understanding of where we are. The power of the world is given to us as disclosure or openness, which is just picking up from Heidegger, Erschlossenheit, openness. But he could also be picking it up from the Crammer, in my view, who talk about openness, Frijambana. So what does this mean? On the one hand, we can think of this as relation between the I and the not I, the subject and the object, as in Husserlian phenomenology. But on the other hand, the world cannot be an object or a being, because it is the condition under which being is given. So this is Lacoste. The world cannot be an intellectual object because it's the condition under which all intellectual objects occur. So it's it's like daylight. You can't see daylight, but it's a condition which allows things to become visible. So the world has already taken possession of Dasein before any awareness or consciousness. So Dasein is all doors and windows, he says, and is reflected in consciousness. I'm not sure about that, but that's what he claims. The world is an opening. So this word opening, he's getting from Heidegger's Origins of the Work of Art. So the world means revealing of being, the revealing of being. So in that Origin of the Work of Art, I'd urge you to read it. It's a great essay where Heidegger asks that question, what is a work of art? He said, well, a work of art is a thing. He said, well, what is a thing? So he then goes on to talk about what a thing is, being the present at hand and the ready at hand and all that, if you remember. Like an instrument is equipment, is ready to hand, whereas just objects are present at hand. So an artwork, says Heidegger, is a kind of, it's neither a thing like an object, nor is it a thing like equipment. It's between the two. And an artwork comprises two things. It comprises world and earth. World opens up meaning. So he takes Van Gogh's painting of the sky or something. Says there's a whole world of meaning opened up through Van Gogh's painting. But it's also the materiality of the thing. You can look at the painting and see the scrapes of the paint and the canvas and all that. So world and earth go together. And Lacoste picks up on this and talks about location and world in terms of these two components of earth and world. So the world has already taken possession of us, he says. So earth cannot be thought without world and vice versa. We need both meaning, world, and materiality in which it is grounded, earth. So I think this is relevant to holiness because you need materiality in order to ground holiness. And then he goes on to talk about a liturgy, which I've rephrased it as ritual or celebration. So the liturgy celebrates the open. And there's just an aside, a bracket here. There's a quote from Heidegger from Ways in the Woods or something, Holzweger, where he says, quote, the open, this is a translation, the open is, oh, I've got the German at the bottom of you. The open is the great entirety of all that is unbarred. It lets the creatures that are risked into the pure attraction pull as things pulled, so that they draw onwards together in diverse ways without hitting against barriers. Pulling as they are pulled, they open out into the great unbarriered, into the infinite. Oh, Heidegger. They are not dissolved into the void of nothing. They are not dissolved into the void of nothing, but they redeem themselves into the whole of the open. Wow. So Herr Martin's gone a long way, I think, from the earlier kind of philosophy. So we conduct ourselves in the open, and Lacoste is picking up on all this openness from Heidegger. Such an opening constitutes the foundation of liturgy, he says, of a liturgy. So liturgy, what does he mean by liturgy? Well, he means the Catholic liturgy, but he also means everything that embraces a relationship between man and God, humanity and transcendence. So liturgy, quote, is the very concept that precludes the ruinous opposition of the interior and the exterior of the body and the soul. By thinking in terms of liturgy, we are constantly compelled to think in terms of place. So that's his main point. Liturgy is celebration of place. And that's fundamentally what human being is. It's a celebration of place. And he says that's the way you get the link between humanity and God, because he's a theologian. So liturgy, he also says, is an act of freedom. So freedom is... Well, I think there's something to that. There's in the participation in liturgy, there's a you're doing what everyone else has done, but it's also done voluntarily. It's also done as an act of freedom. So I think it's getting at something like the greater the restriction at one level, the greater the freedom, and the less restriction, the less freedom. So like an amoeba hasn't got much choice. It's not very constrained. It's very limited, but also its freedom is limited. Whereas human beings are really highly constrained, massive of constraints upon us. And yet we're the greatest, the most free, arguably, within the range of creatures that we know about. Freedom. So the place unfolds a secular space, but can unfold a sacred place as well. So I think this is where holiness comes in, because Lacoste says that we can have secular place, of course, but we can also have sacred place. And that's to do with freedom. We can choose what kind of place we create, I suppose. It is both our destiny and a decision that we make. But the God that liturgy presents us with may not belong to the field of experience. He doesn't like the category of experience. On the back of his book, it says that he supports Schleiermacher's view, but he doesn't. It's the very opposite. He supports, he's anti-Schleiermacher. So whoever's the blurbist for that book has got it wrong. Much. Yeah, I don't know. It's crazy, isn't it? So what are the implications of this? If this is right, sorry, time's going on, I've got to get on. What are the implications for human experience in relation to language and holiness? Is experience of holiness as the overwhelming outside of language? Perhaps world as the open, as opening of meaning, entails language, which is nevertheless rooted in materiality of earth, which is non or pre-linguistic. These are all questions, all speculation. Holiness as human appearance necessarily entails world and earth, which is language or consciousness, and earth, materiality in which it is, system of science. So language is material. It's categories in the brain. I think it can even locate spaces in the brain where the words are. I don't know enough about neuroscience. But there's a materiality of the sign, which is very important, I think, in the understanding of the nature of holiness in human life. So both entail body and bringing body into harmony or resonance with world and earth. So both world, both language and consciousness, and earth, materiality, entail body. Both we've got language and consciousness and materiality in our bodies. And our bodies are the way that we are in world, in location. And we can bring body into harmony or resonance with world and earth, with meaning and earth. And holiness is perhaps a mesocosmic place for that manifestation between the microcosm, which we understand and can see, and the macrocosm, which we can study with the James Webb telescope and all that. And maybe there's something to do with the mesocosm, the hidden body, if you like, of the mesocosm is the location for the appearance of holiness. So there are two views then. Experience is pre-linguistic. This is a slightly different topic, but I can bring it back together in the end. And then human experience entails language. Just whizzed through. Oh, I'm going to talk about Otto. Sorry, I was doing this quite late at night. But the overwhelming as pre-linguistic.
Some of us might have to leave a little early for a class.
Okay, yes. Okay, well, I'll better shut up. I'll just.
Please, just wanted to let you know.
Good. So there's two views then. There's the overwhelming as pre-linguistic human experience, and the other one as the constitutive view in which language is important. I won't go through these. But the conclusion then, there are two modes of holiness, this is what I've tried to present, ontology and axiology, that can be reframed as the overwhelming and the ethical. And if we go back to basics, the nature of who we are, we can see that both are constitutive of the human. And we might say, so this is language is constitutive of what it is to be human. Secondly, place is our mode of being in the world, getting that from Lacoste. Thirdly, celebration, which is Lacoste liturgy, is the way we experience place, which is not outside of language. I mean, you go to, I think, even a discotheque is a kind of celebration of place, isn't it, really, I suppose? And holiness comes out of place because of attunement to harmony, cosmic resonance, and homology, perhaps, rather than analogy. I want to look at that closer. So perhaps we can say, at the end of the day, that holiness is both ontological and axiological, overwhelming and ethical, and is indwelling in a place in the mode of celebration. Indwelling in place in place in the mode of celebration is openness. So I think that might be a definition of holiness that my fevered brain came up with last night.